it asked. Will you take me to my mother, who died of grief for my only brother's death, in the early days of the war? I am very tired. I want to see my old mother. The eyes of the rose-veiled stranger were luminous with wonder. Why, there is even love in this strange star, it said. April 11th. Letter 20, Above the Battlefields. Picture to yourself a battlefield, a long stretching irregular double line of men and guns and horses and all the paraphernalia of war. In the old days on Earth I once gave some study to the theory and practice of war, but that labor had little value in preparing me to study this war. Not only did it take for granted conditions that no longer exist, but my point of observation then was an imaginary station on one side or the other of an imaginary field. Now I am really here, there and everywhere. I read the thoughts of the commanders on both sides. I am with the men in the trenches, sometimes half buried in mud and water. I am riding with the cavalry. I go forward with the guns of the artillery. I go out and up with the escaping spirits of the dead, go with them into the hell of confusion that almost always swallows them for a time after they are violently thrust from their bodies. Truly, war is hell. Have no glorious delusions to the contrary, you who dwell in the haunts of peace and babble of what you know not. The horrors do not end when the guns cease firing. The dark and silent night of rain is full of souls in bewilderment and torment. Often one will grope his way hither and thither, seeking to find a trench mate to whom he had become attached in the camaraderie of war, that sweet flower which grows up an ugly stem. Often they live over and over again the rage and madness of the attack. They plunge an imaginary bayonet into the form of an imaginary foe, or, if a mass of them are together, and they generally are, they strike recklessly at anything before them, conscious always of an opposing force. The general of whom I wrote in my last letter was a man of marked spiritual development. He soon broke away from the entanglements of matter. He was a devotee to whom his country was a god and his emperor a hero to be followed with aspiration. But most men who die on the battlefields are common soldiers who fight because it is the will of the mass behind them. They generally go out into darkness for a time, and most of them wander in darkness and bewilderment for varying periods. Some, on the contrary, are vividly conscious almost from the hour of death. These may attack the men of the opposing army when they sleep. The dreams of the battlefields are terrible in their intensity. Sometimes again, for in the general confusion distinctions may be quite lost, souls that had believed themselves enemies cling together in the tragic yearning of the dark that separates the worlds of the invisible. In their great need they do not know their former friends from their former enemies. Another pale flower that grows from the ugly stem of war. The astral forms of men of low development are often found here in shocking distortion, their consciousness only a glimmer, and with no power of feeling anything but pain. No wonder the dreams of the unselfish lovers of humanity are full of horror during these dark nights of the world, for there are many non-combatants in all lands whose hours of sleep are given to a devoted labor for the souls that need help so horribly. There is one man whom you know who bears at this time a burden almost superhuman, and speaks of it to no one. It is needless for me to say how you yourself spent the nights of many months, and when we bade you cease that labor it was only that you might have more strength for the labor of writing these pages at my dictation. A soul still held in the flesh cannot work all day and all night. That is burning the astral candle at both ends. When you return to the countries now devastated by war, some of your friends will relate to you experiences similar to your own during these terrible months. They who can be used are called upon when the need is greatest, and the need is immense at this time. Realize that those souls in the lower regions of the astral world are actually in space near the ground of the physical planet. Those who hang over the battlefields where they met their fate are still thrilled or horrified by the noise of the battle horns. They can still hear the shriek of shells and feel the shattering force of the explosions. Day in, day out these unfortunate earthbound ones live over and over again the emotions of war. Night after night they dread the morning when the sounds will begin again. They cannot get away. They are not free merely because their bodies are buried under a few feet of earth, or worse still, left unburied. I advise you to avoid for some years at least the actual scenes of these battles. You can go to Switzerland or to the more southern regions of France, but do not stay long in northern France or Belgium, or in any other place that may be thus affected. The thought world of England is just now troubled, but the layer of astral matter immediately above the earth is not full of the awful emanations of death. Astral forms go there from the more terrible region, but in order to go they must have themselves broken away from the immediate scene of their worst suffering. It is easier to protect oneself from sad thought forms than from the distracted astral entities and the boiling astral matter that lie above those battlefields. Why, even the field of Waterloo before this war was not a pleasant place to spend the night. After a lapse of time you may briefly visit the scenes of these recent battles, for the sake of the practical experience, but do not go there just yet. The best place in Europe for a long period will be the mountains of Switzerland. You should spend much time there. Do you remember telling me how, when a child, you used to see the forms of American Indians on the hills and in the valleys of your native state? They were those who many years before had walked those hills and valleys in the sunlight, and who were still held in the tenuous matter above that region. The eyes of childhood are sometimes very clear. Above those battlefields of Europe, the sensitive eye may see for many years the forms of those who will not be able to make their escape. And I do not mean Akashic records. War is hell, and the hell does not end with the signing of peace papers. That is one reason why we want you, and those others who believe in brotherhood, to carry that spirit of brotherhood among the nations that have been at war. You have no conception of the power of a quiet faith in a great and true idea. The man who really loves his fellows has a wider influence than his own immediate circle of friends. The atmosphere around him is permeated with that brotherly love, and sensitive souls can feel it. Someday sail up the Rhine with that sentiment in your heart. April 12th. Letter 21, A Soul in Purgatory. Dare I talk to you of the purgatory to which the rage of battle conducts so many souls that only a little while before walked the earth as men, and went their daily round from house to office, loving their wives and children and exchanging worldly commonplaces in the intervals of work, all unmindful that they were hourly drifting toward the great event? Yes, I dare. We will follow one soul that I myself followed. His story I can reconstruct from memory, for every act of it is stamped upon my mind. No, I do not need brain cells to remember with. Neither will you, when you have escaped the prison of your brain cells. The man was an officer in an English regiment and he was a bachelor. Outwardly he was much like other men, but his consciousness was different. He lived in a world of his own, for he was a reader and a thinker. He was not a very good man. Not all Englishmen are good even now when England is at war. You who bristle at any criticism of your beloved maternal island, you who write for me. This man was not very good because there was so little love in his heart. He was not incapable of love, yet he was unable to awaken love in others, and so was soul-starved. But sometimes he was conscious of a great yearning, and when the yearning came he was impatient, and took a drink, or cursed his servant, or both. Sometimes when he was most impatient with the world and with himself, he went on a spree. The war began. His natural impatience found something congenial in the hurry and noise of the expedition. He was glad to go. He had known a German in London and had disliked him thoroughly. The German talked too much, and his loud tones jarred on the sensitive ears of the refined officer. As he led his men into battle, he thought of this German. He felt that he was battling with him at last face to face, and the feeling gave him a thrill of satisfaction. Hate had become an almost sensual luxury. The German had fascinated by his blustering personality a woman of rather coarse type to whom the officer had been impatiently attracted. He hated himself for the attraction, and he hated the German for frustrating it. We always hate those who frustrate the emotions we hate. The officer was killed by a German bullet, in the early days of the war. Where? Oh, no matter where. There are those who might recognize the man, and I am not a betrayer of unwilling confidences. When I listen at the keyhole of life, I never report too much of what I hear. I use my discretion. I shall call this man my friend, for I was so much his friend that I have a right to claim him. Before the battle in which my friend met death, I had lingered near him, with a desire to soften the hard feelings in his heart. Those feelings are not usual among the soldiers of a particular section of the northern battle line. To them, fighting is a sort of glorified sport, or it was so last September. My friend was an exception, and that is why I choose to write about him, that my assertion of his exceptional qualities may keep the reader from shuddering too much. I should not like my readers to feel that their friends went through a similar experience. You who hang above this page, my friend was not your friend. The experiences of your friends were less terrible. They were all better men than he, because you loved them, and this man was not good because he was not loved enough. He met death by a rifle bullet. Then all became dark before him, and he was unconscious for a time. He was awakened by the noise of a bursting shell. The battle has begun, he thought. Damn that man. He should have awakened me at dawn. He was among the men of his regiment. They seemed larger than usual, and blurred in outline. He rubbed his eyes. Helen's damnation. Who have they put in my place? For he saw a minor officer who commanded where he had commanded. He turned away, then came back again. He would demand to know. He started toward the place where his superior officer should have been, some distance away, and found himself instantly there. What is the matter with me? He thought. Have I lost my mind? He saluted the officer, who paid no attention to him. Am I asleep? He wondered. He went up to a soldier who was loading a rifle and touched him on the arm. The soldier also paid no attention. He gripped the man's arm. Still he paid no attention, but raised his rifle and fired. My friend went toward two men who were talking together. Poor old. He heard one of them say. Shot through the heart. He was a good officer, though a surly fellow. I'm sorry he's dead. The they spoke of was himself. Shot through the heart, a good officer, a surly fellow, dead. He knew. Knowledge sometimes comes more slowly. He was dead. Just my luck. Was his instinctive thought. Another shell burst behind him with a shattering report. Suddenly he saw before him a face that riveted his attention. It was a malignant, an insolent face. Then it changed into the face of his enemy, the German back in England whom he hated. So it's you, is it? He asked. The spectre made no answer, but changed its shape again. This time it was like the woman whom my friend had hated himself for liking. You, too. He said, impatiently. Again the spectre changed countenance. It was like a servant whom my friend had cursed once too often, and who had left him the year before. Are you, too, dead? He asked, but the face before him had now resumed its original appearance. It was merely a malignant, insolent face, resembling nobody in particular. What are you, anyway? My friend demanded, but still there was no answer. The eye of the spectre interested him, the left eye. As he gazed at it, the eye gradually enlarged until it seemed the size of a target in a shooting gallery. The iris, of a peculiar greenish blue, was in the very middle of the eye, so that the white showed all round. The black pupil stared at him with its concentrated malice, a pupil large as a saucer. Why do you do that? Demanded my friend, but the eye still made no answer. Then it vanished. A troop of hateful shades came in its place, ugly shades, some human, some subhuman. Another shell burst nearby, and the shades began to dance. They caught at him and whirled him around with them, around and around until he was dizzy. Then suddenly they stopped, and each and all of them changed into the form of the German back in England whom my friend had hated. Then another group of mad beings mingled with them. They also changed suddenly. There were a dozen duplicates of the woman whom my friend had hated himself for liking, and they and the duplicates of his enemy caught one another's hands and kissed each other. sick, revolted, my friend wished himself away, and he was away. He was over among the soldiers of the German army across the plain. He heard the sounds of the language he disliked. What the devil? He thought, and the devil stood before him, hoofs, horns and tail complete. Hadn't thought of me before, had you? Sneered the evil being. My friend was hurt and bewildered by the appearance, for it looked, with all its unlovely accessories, so like himself. Will you, too, change form in a moment? He asked. Oh, no. I change slowly. I only change as you change. What do you mean? You only can change me. Change, then, said my friend. But the demon remained as before. Change, repeated my friend, but still the figure before him changed not at all. Then you lied when you said I could change you. I said that I change slowly. What do you mean? I only change as you change. And I have not changed, then? It is my business to keep you from changing. In company with his devil, my friend now went through scenes which I refrain from describing, Goethe in the Walpurgis Night having done it so well before me. Reckless, desperate, he followed his leader until he was weary and exhausted. Days, weeks passed away, like a nightmare. Can I never get rid of you? He asked his companion. Yes, you can get rid of me. How? By getting rid of yourself. That's easier said than done. Yes, that's easier said than done. Often they found themselves on the battlefield in the fighting line, or at the mess of the soldiers. The smell of the coffee and the cooking meats brought temporary satisfaction to my friend. He tried to drink from brandy flasks tilted to the mouths of men who could not see him or protest. He steeped himself in hungers and despairs. His companions were always changing themselves into the forms of the man he hated and the woman he loved. He witnessed their coarse lovemaking. Sometimes the simulacrum of the woman turned to him with a friendly word. He cursed her, but clung to her hand. But always she vanished when his mouth yearned to hers. Sometimes in a great battle the rage of war awoke in him. He hurled himself at the men of the opposing army, as if he would take revenge upon them for all he was suffering. He struggled to tear the rifles from their hands, and when one of them passed out of the body he tried to awake him from the darkness and the sleep into which he was sinking, but never could he succeed in doing this. Never could he succeed in doing anything. His very existence was failure and futility and discouragement. One day I came to him and touched him on the forehead. You are not like these others, he said, dully. Where do you come from? I came from a distance, I said. Would you like to go with me? Anywhere away from here, he assented. Do you want to be alone? No. It is worst when I am alone. The worst is over, I said. What do you mean? I mean that you have exhausted for the time the springs of your lower desires. You are weary and disgusted with the life you have led since you escaped your body. That is a strange expression, escaped. It is only now that I long to escape. And it is I that will help you to escape from another layer of your prison, another skin of the onion that shuts you in. And why do you do this? To spare you unnecessary fumbling to break the skin, I said. Would you like to go to sleep? I should like to rest a little. While he slept, I helped to loosen him further, and when he awoke into another and freer world, I was still with him. What would you like to see? I asked. Something beautiful, he answered, something beautiful and pure. Would you care to witness a dance of elves? I asked, smiling. A dance of elves? Are there really such things? The universe contains innumerable forms of life and consciousness, I said. And you who believe in devils from experience can surely believe in elves. They came toward us as I spoke, lithe, tenuous forms, dancing with joy across the flowery spaces of the Elysian fields. They swayed and circled around us, those beings pure as the air in which they moved, light as the happiness they exhaled, enduring as hope and lovelier than mortal dreams. The shadows had all gone from my friend's face, and he too seemed to taste joy. He too was light as air, and pure. He joined their dance and circled with them around me. I tell you in a burst of confidence that I also have danced with elves. This companion and friend of the beautiful being has swum in the sea of universal life and floated on the wings of irresponsibility. He who knows too much of the world's sorrow must sometimes lighten the load by knowing nothing but joy. When the sylphs had gone to their more inviolable retreat, another shape came toward us. "What would you like to see now?" I asked him. "Can I see a person who still lives in England?" he asked, half shyly, yet with the winning confidence of souls who trust their own desires, the higher wisdom which comes with the purification of desire. "Perhaps," I said. The form that came toward us was unfamiliar to me, but my friend recognized and welcomed it. A woman of intense and vital personality, yet with that purity of atmosphere without which no communion is possible in the region where we then were, was standing beside my friend. "Let us sit together a little," I said. "It will seem more home-like." The two beside me seemed happy in each other's presence. Sisterly sweet hand in hand, they sat together, and though I knew that one of them was only the simulacrum of a living woman, yet she also seemed real to me for the moment, for the kind sentiments of the heart are real, and in the region to which I had conducted my friend all sentiments are kind. No enemies are found there, and the woman he liked also liked him, or she could not have been there. Soon I left them in each other's company and went back to the labors of the battlefield. For there were others who needed me, and my friend was safe for the time. After a while I shall help him onward to an experience still less restricted. We take an interest in those whom we have helped, and wish to help them further. Why did I choose this man for my friendly ministrations, you are wondering, for as I described him in the beginning of this letter he was not an attractive character. I tell you a little secret. It was because he was unattractive that I chose him. No one had ever loved him enough, and so he needed help more than others. Those who are loved are already helped by that love. As the beautiful being says, "Do you get my meaning, daughter of Earth? Just now I live to serve mankind through the horrors of this war. Serve also by loving those who least attract your love. So shall you learn the way to the path where walk the masters of compassion." April 14th. Letter 22, Peace Propaganda. Were you shocked and grieved by what I told you of the futile struggle in that intermediate world between the bondage of dense matter and the freedom of purer regions? It is nothing to grieve about, it is nothing but the necessary transition stage. It lasts but a little while, a few days, a few years, what matter, in the endless leisure of eternity? You yourself have passed through it many times. All pass through it in going out to a freer life, though all do not suffer it consciously and lingeringly as my friend did. It is a nightmare, yes, but no nightmare lasts forever. Think of the joy and the freedom beyond. They are worth the boatman's penny. It is true that I have not told you the most terrible things that are possible in this transition. Have not told you the most terrible things that I have seen in my journeys round the battlefields. Those unwritten chapters are not necessary for the book which I dictate to teach brotherhood in place of separation, peace in place of war. Would you know how you may do something to shorten this war, to hasten the coming of peace? Then listen. You can personally hasten the coming of peace. Is the idea startling? When I say you, I mean others, too. All those who are weary of war, and of hate, the mother of war. Has anyone injured you in the struggle of life? For life is a kind of war. Go out in thought to those whose desires have clashed with your desires, those who have hurt you or hated you. Go to them one by one, not several at a time in this exercise, and one by one try to understand them. See yourself with their eyes, feel toward yourself with their hearts. If they still hate you, you may hate yourself at first in sympathy with them. But remaining there in sympathy with them, you will gradually feel their hard thoughts of you change, gradually begin to be friends with yourself through them. This I am advising you to do is not a form of black magic, because the object is unselfish, You are making a beginning toward softening the enmities of the world. But I warn you against using this practice to win the regard of anyone whom you love selfishly or with passion, because the reaction would bring about a very undesirable condition of disharmony. When you have thus understood and forgiven all your personal enemies, entered the souls of the warring nations, understand them also by sympathy, and soften their hearts. Though this is a much easier thing to attempt than the other, the results may seem incommensurable with the effort. But, small and great, you are all part of the whole. And this brings me to the idea of race spirits, race entities, for every race has its guardian being, a composite being, yet self-conscious as separate, in a way you could hardly understand. Have you not noticed the effect on yourself of passing from country to country? Have your feelings, has your consciousness not changed almost at the frontier? Do you remember the shock you once had on setting foot for the first time in a certain foreign land? The race spirits seem no larger to themselves than you humans do among your friends and acquaintances. Size is relative. Heretofore I have spoken of the races as organs in the body of humanity. In speaking of them now as separate beings, I am not contradicting myself. What reason have you for assuming that the organs of your body may not each be animated by a more or less separate consciousness? Your cells exist in your organs exist in your body, you exist in your race exists in the body of humanity on Earth, the entity of the Earth exists in the democracy of planetary spirits in the solar system exists as one in the company of its fellows in the greater democracy of the cosmos. A small blood clot on the brain could seriously hamper the working of your cosmos. So you see, there is nothing preposterous in my saying that you can hasten infinitesimally the peace between the race spirits by forgiving and making peace with your personal enemies, especially if they belong to races on the other side of this war. The small is not so unimportant and the great is not so important as you have the habit of supposing. Yes, you personally, and all of you, can hasten the coming of peace. April 16th. Letter 23, The Mystery of Desire. I have written about the hunger and thirst of disembodied men in the astral world, and I have written about the evil astral beings who brought about this war to satisfy their malice. They too are hungry beings and the war has given them food. Do you know what they live on? They may live long on blood and the exhalations of slaughter. I have seen them by myriads hovering over a battlefield, gorging themselves on the blood that dripped from the wounds of suffering men and from dead men. The leaving of the dead unburied has also satisfied their hunger. Vampire entities came up from Hungary and from other countries and fed on the living. The awful weariness of war opened a door through which they might pass to the life forces they craved. Blood is a peculiar fluid, as Goethe said. The life of an evil entity may be renewed for another long period of existence if he can have blood enough. If you stop eating the carcasses of dead animals, you will cease to feed certain evil entities in yourselves. It is not merely for reasons of sentiment that the pupils of the great masters are advised to refrain from animal food. You are told that meat-eating feeds the passional nature. What is the passional nature but the hungry nature that longs to feed on something not itself? So long as you eat meat habitually, you will never be quite free from the influence of entities who live on the blood and the other properties of meat. Eat purely, and by you will find yourselves thinking purely and desiring purely. I do not tell you to kill out all desire this afternoon, for desire is the dynamics with which you work for even the ideal, but kill out desire for blood and the flesh of dead animals, and all sorts of other desires which serve no necessary purpose in your evolution will expire. A lot of nonsense is talked about desire. You desire to develop spiritually, you desire to do the work of the masters, you are not merely led along like a lamb to do the work of the masters. There is desire and desire. If it seems desirable that you shorten the road to conscious union with the all, you will desire that union probably, you are not likely to drift into it. I am not talking about the violent desires of ambition. You need not be ambitious for occult development. In fact, if you are too ambitious for occult development, you will be in danger of becoming a black magician. But you can quietly desire even union with God.